Hello, everyone. Good to see everyone here, and good to be on this panel. It's a great honor to be with Eleanor and with Ben. I was thinking about wearing a Halloween costume today, and I couldn't come up with anything really good. But then, at the last minute, I realized I did have a good Halloween costume with me. I was dressed as Ben Meyer, which it involves wearing a suit and having a beard, and so it's a pretty easy costume to. So. Yes, I did know that. So you have now 15 or 20 minutes to think of your response to that. Okay, so anyway, my topic today is going to be, it's a project that I've been thinking about, and I freely admit that it's still in its formative stages, and so I'm looking forward to feedback on what you think of how this hangs together. And it addresses human rights for health governance, and it's going to be looking at a couple of different ways that we can conceive of human rights systems that might be a little bit different than the way that we typically think about human rights systems in the context of governance for health. And so I'm going to look at three different areas. I'm going to focus on, first, the conceptual level of how we conceive of human rights. Eleanor, in her presentation, in the previous presentation, gave a really eloquent description of the foundations of human rights, the fact that they're grounded on this fundamental idea that individuals have these basic rights that cannot be taken away, and they come to individuals on the basis of their humanity. They don't need to be given or granted by governments or by anyone else, and that is the foundational understanding of the human rights system. That was the foundational breakthrough, the conceptual breakthrough of the human rights system when it was developed. And I want to talk about how that understanding of human rights is consistent with and can be built upon to talk about human rights systems as a tool of governance, as a way that we can actually, and a means by which we can actually seek to achieve good health outcomes. And then I'm also going to talk about how developments in both the structural and normative aspects of human rights systems have both expanded over recent years and contribute to that potential for using human rights as a governor of health systems and health outcomes, and an improver of health outcomes. Okay, and I'm going to do all of that, talk about it generally, but I want to come back later in the presentation to a specific example of a human rights system, a human rights instrument that I think really fits in well with this idea, and is really innovative in many ways, and that's the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. It's the most recent international human rights treaty, and has a number of really innovative features that I think are actually really exciting in terms of the development of human rights systems, and I'll talk about that more later. Okay, so in a lot of the work that I've done on this issue has focused on human rights as they relate to persons with disabilities, and in particular mental and intellectual disabilities. And this is an extremely important issue. That the heading of our section today, I believe, is human rights for social justice. And if the groups in our society that are probably most vulnerable to abuses of their human rights are people with mental and intellectual disabilities. These health conditions are extremely widespread. If you look at some of the international surveys, that they estimate that about 450 million people worldwide have some kind of psychosocial or intellectual disability. And some of these are very significant conditions, like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, that require extensive and ongoing treatment. And then there are other things that are maybe less severe, things even like everyday stress that might be considered debilitating in some ways. And so when you look at this and you look at how human rights systems either protect or fail to protect people with mental and intellectual disabilities, you see that until recently it was a very lacking picture. And that's one of the reasons why the new UN Convention is so exciting from the perspective of people who are trying to advance the cause of human rights. Another thing to note is that when you think about how these human rights systems apply and how they're implemented, if you look at national legislation around the world, you see that only it's less than half of countries have mental health legislation that explicitly has been revised in the last 10 to 15 years. Most of these older laws don't take into account rights-based approaches, and so you have a lot of mental health laws that are extremely punitive, that don't recognize rights, that allow people to be sent to involuntary confinement without much due process, without much substantive justification, and provide insufficient remedies for people to actually petition to be released from involuntary confinement. You also see quite even more widespread way in lots of countries around the world. There really is no effective way to claim access to mental health treatment. And that's an ongoing problem, and one that's both a human rights problem, but also a problem of resources and funding. Okay, so and a final set of problems here when you're talking about human rights and accessing rights is that there's limited participation of people who have mental and intellectual disabilities in either being in the discussion, in the room, to advocate for their own rights. Eleanor mentioned in one of her final slides, you know, the table of people sitting around carving up the policy decisions, and where were the people, where were the consumers? Well, these particular consumers are almost always left out of the room. And even if you have effective consumer advocates, they're not typically taking into account the special kinds of considerations that would affect these populations of people. So, now, I want to go back to what I was talking about at the very outset, which is this sort of different way of thinking about, or maybe expanded way of thinking about human rights systems as a tool of health governance. If we're thinking about human rights as the foundation for individual protections for any people, including people with disabilities, we're going to be, that's sort of the traditional, typical understanding of human rights and why they exist and why the approach of human rights is a very powerful one. But we can also think of human rights as a shaper of health systems. And I'm going to elaborate on that in the next couple of slides. We've seen in recent years a proliferation of human rights. We've seen new treaties, new legislation at the national level, and we've seen a lot of advancement in both the structural aspects and normative aspects of human rights. Now what I mean by that is, with the development of new human rights treaties and the development of and the ongoing interpretation of these treaties, we see an increasing number of venues through which people who have rights claims can bring them. And so whether it's recognition of rights claims at national levels, or it's the development of new treaties like the CRPD that have enforcement mechanisms, although their enforcement mechanisms are somewhat lacking, and we can talk about that as well. You have essentially a much more robust infrastructure in place, and it's only part of the way there. To have a consistent and broad application of and access to human rights protections, these systems need to continue to be structurally developed. But the structures have increased and they've proliferated. The normative aspects of it have proliferated as well. And what I mean by that is that, particularly, I'll use the example of the right to health. In the last 12 to 15 years, there's been an extensive development of the norms of the right to health. What does the right to health include? What does it encompass? How would a country that is upholding the right to health, how would they provide, and what would they provide for individuals in their population? And this is an important development. It also introduces a little bit of complexity because you have different organizations, including bodies at the international level, including sort of formal articulations of the right, like General Comment 14 of the International Covenant of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, including different agencies in the UN, including national organizations, both formal within the government and outside of the government, interpreting and trying to interpret what these rights mean. And then you also have, less so with the right to health, but more so with other human rights, litigation going on, where you have courts interpreting what these rights mean. And that's equally important in the normative development of these kinds of systems. I also want to mention that there are multiple ways that this is occurring. This isn't only occurring in international treaties. This is also occurring in national laws and in governments in the national level. It's also occurring outside of formal government processes. And so I'll come back to this in a minute. But I think that this is probably the area where there's the most upside potential in terms of using human rights approaches for governance. Is even outside of the formal infrastructure between government and international agencies. And finally, we've begun to see what I'll refer to as the diffusion and incorporation of norms. We're starting to see that some of these ideas, some of these interpretations of rights, transferring between different systems. And so one example, a couple of years ago, there was a prominent case in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which is one of the regional human rights courts, that in addition to recognizing rights violations against a person who had been kept in an institutional facility without adequate access to health care, and without adequate protection for life and due process, the court not only cited to the precedents within its own jurisdiction and the materials that established rights within that regional human rights system, it also cited to cases in the European Court of Human Rights and referred to normative understandings that were developed by the UN in other contexts. And this, I think, is an important development if it continues. There are a few anecdotes of this, and it'll be interesting to see whether this actually becomes a more widespread kind of initiative or sequence of events. Now, I do think, though, that diffusion and incorporation of norms can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing, right? So it depends if the norms are norms that we want to diffuse or not. And so it's not necessarily always going to be good, but it does show that these systems are complicated and interconnected. Now, I think the thunderbolt or lightning bolt that made me think about this in a more detailed way was I was working on a different project that was looking at theories of governance, and I was looking at them in the context of public health emergencies, and I was reading a lot of literature on governance theory and different models of governance, and I was thinking that this actually has a lot of connection to the way that human rights systems are structured, and that human rights systems themselves can be thought of as tools of governance. The definition when I'm talking about governance, I'm talking about any kind of effort that's being employed to seek to influence or exert control on the course of events in a system. And so if we're talking about human rights governance, it's all the activities and functions and exercises of management, influence, and control that may be applied to achieve designated human rights ends. Now, you'll notice that this definition doesn't include, it doesn't outline who is making who's engaging in these activities, functions, and exercises of management. And it also doesn't say specifically what the designated human rights ends should be. And I think both of those are important pieces to understanding this idea, and hopefully can elaborate on that in a minute and also in the questions. Now, divided the governance models into three different categories, and I'll briefly explain what these categories mean. The first model is traditional governance structures. And traditional governance models. These are formal structures of institutional governance. Typically, it's looking at either the government itself or looking at maybe a formal international organization that's created through a treaty. And so these kinds of infrastructures and the activities of governments and these international institutions are kind of the formalized version of governance. They're legal authorities supporting their actions. The human rights system in many ways is grounded on a type of formal governance, although I'll give you the big caveat in a minute. It's grounded on a form of formal governance because the way the systems are structured, individuals bring claims and the obligations for fulfilling those claims are put on the governments themselves. National governments have the obligations to protect human rights and to ensure that they're being upheld. And so you can go from this traditional approach and you can think about that model contrasted with what I'll refer to as new governance and devolved governance models. Now, new governance models, at least in the literature, are models that look at the intersection of the formal governance structures with external actors. There's been a lot of talk about this, particularly in Europe, in terms of having the formal government structures cooperate with and partner with non-governmental actors, and they might be public or private sector actors to allow for more exchange of ideas, and actually more influence of those non-governmental actors on government decisions. Now, in some cases this might be very good, in some cases this might be very bad, depending on who those actors are and what their influence might be. But these kinds of models in some ways democratize the approach. They allow for more participants in the governance process, and allow these less formal relationships to impact outcomes. Now you see some of this in human rights systems as well. There are a lot of organizations that are not formal government structures that do quite a lot of human rights work, and particularly NGOs, civil society organizations, and others who are either advocating directly for individuals to protect human rights through either through litigation or through other kinds of mechanisms, but very often in policy development and education, and having an actual impact on the behaviors of both government officials and people throughout society in a way that might help to protect human rights. And now, because it's outside of the formal system, and this sort of brings me to my third category, which is devolved governance. This is the diffusion of governance ideas very broadly. There are a lot of different ways to look at this kind of idea. The one that I think is probably the most relevant to this context is descriptions of what's called nodal governance, where you have different nodes throughout society, and it might be government officials, but it might be your local community organizations, it could be religious groups, it could be nonprofit advocacy organizations, who are actually actively engaging in the management of the course of events in the system. And it could be individuals themselves who engage in that management through bringing claims or petitioning for policy changes. And so it sort of complicates the scenario here. But what I'd like to suggest is that all three of these governance models are relevant in the context of human rights, and that they operate simultaneously. Let me, I'm starting to run out of time here. I want to talk about how the CRPD, let me say two or three things about the CRPD that I haven't mentioned. What's really innovative about the CRPD is that it takes a very broad approach to the protection of rights for people with disabilities. In fact, here's the definition of disability that's included in the convention. And let me point out two things about this that I think are particularly innovative. The first is that it's open-ended. It doesn't constrain the definition of disability to a certain number of specified categories. But it does mention some categories like physical, mental, intellectual, or sensory impairments. But it doesn't limit it to just those categories. The second really innovative thing here is that it defines disability not as some kind of inherent physical or mental or sensory limitation. It's these conditions which in interaction with various barriers may hinder the ability of these individuals to fully and effectively participate in society on an equal basis with others. So it recognizes that this is not a medical diagnosis that makes someone disabled. It's the fact that someone has these conditions and that society doesn't allow for them to, that because of the way that society is structured, they are hindered from full and equal participation. And of course, the goal of this document and the goal of taking a human rights approach to this is to ensure that individuals with disabilities can have that full and effective and equal participation in society. I should mention also that it's been widely ratified at this point, even though it's only been in existence for a few years. The convention has 153 signatories, 106 ratifications. The U.S. has signed it, but of course not ratified it. We don't ratify human rights treaties anymore in this country, I don't think. Okay, so I'll wrap up, because I know I'm just about out of time, by talking about how I think the CRPD actually fits into all three of these categories of governance, and then hopefully we can have more discussion after the session. I think that in some important ways, it does fit into all three categories. The traditional governance model is supported by the formal infrastructure created by the treaty and by its imposition on governments to uphold the human rights obligations that the treaty articulates. I think the more interesting and newer advances that are created within this treaty come under the other two headings. So you've got under the new governance approach, you see an explicit an explicit discussion within the treaty of how non-governmental organizations should work together and partner with government officials to try to uphold the different tenets of the treaty. And this is something that is sort of implicit in other human rights treaties, but in this treaty it's actually laid out there. And there actually are certain requirements. So for example, the inclusion of the input of some of these outside groups in the development of national strategies to implement the treaty. And finally, in terms of the devolved governance category, there's also a series of provisions, including the development of educational provisions for implementing the treaty. And excuse me for 1 second. I can find it. The other example of devolved that I wanted to mention is that there's a structure that's inherent to all human rights treaties, which is the individual ability to redress grievances. And in particular, in this treaty, the optional protocol allows for individuals to directly bring claims to the central committee that's created at the international level, which, again, further literally devolves the governance to individuals. They don't have to go through their national systems exclusively, and it kind of goes to the point I was making before, that the proliferation of these systems can allow for multiple venues to actually try to achieve these goals. So just to conclude, I think that the kernel of the new idea that I'm really trying to pull out of this is that I think that that these human rights systems, including the CRPD, have the potential to be looked at as both a system that protects individual rights, but also as a system that can help us to achieve better health governance. That using rights-based approaches, as developed in these systems, can and using the norms and structures that have evolved through these systems, can be seen as a mode of governance. And this is an idea that I think needs a lot further development. But I'm looking forward to hearing what people think about it, and hopefully to a good discussion. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to your questions.